And then on the morning, that Wednesday morning, J.J. Abrams changed his mind. And instead of 20 stormtroopers, he only needed 5 or so. And we got cut. The 3 most important things, my boss put me aside. I was like, you do have to be a little bit more indirect. You have to say, if you don't mind, please could you do this? And many thanks in advance. How do you actually make sure that people care within the first few seconds?
Here's a fun two-parter question.
It's very exciting because we've been able to create some really, really fun things. Hi, I'm Bram, and I'm taking you behind the future.
To another episode of Behind the Future. I'm your host, Becky Sims, and I have a fantastic co-host with me today. I have the wonderful Ray. Ray, tell us a bit about yourself.
Hi, I'm Ray. I'm a student in year 12 and I'm interested in film.
Fantastic. Well, I think we're going to get into that a little bit today then. And then we have a wonderful guest with us today, the fabulous Bram. Bram, tell us who you are and what you do.
I'm Bram. I'm the head of brand and digital for a really, really big law firm. So my specialty is doing content. So all sorts of content, whether that is text-based or video-based or image-based kind of content is my cup of tea.
Definitely. Well, we're going to dive right into that. So over to you, Ray, for the first question.
Yeah. So what is it exactly that you do?
So I'm the head of brand and digital. So that means I actually look after the law firm's digital channels, as well as how we position ourselves in the markets from a brand point of view. So I always say that I'm from the marketing department. We have a very big marketing department of, I think it's between 120 and 150 people. And a lot of the BD managers and marketing managers in that team think about the what. What is it that we're going to focus on this year in terms of the topics? What is it that we might want to do this year, whether that's a thought leadership report or a certain event? And my team basically does the how. How can we actually promote that event or that report? How can we actually make that report look as good as possible? How can we make that engaging? How can we actually make sure that people on social media get that content? So that's maybe turning it into videos or social media posts and so on. So that's why I always say we're the team of the how when it comes to marketing.
Love that. It's a really nice way to explain it, actually.
It makes it easier in terms of differentiating what the different people do in our teams, given that there's so many of us.
And that's a huge team. Like, because how big's the law firm in general then?
So it's about 8,000 people, or 8,000 lawyers globally.
Wow.
And the markets that I look after are the UK, Scotland, Central and Eastern Europe, Middle East and Asia Pacific. And that's about half of that. So, it's quite a bit. I think by numbers, we are the biggest law firm in Europe and the biggest in the UK.
Amazing. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. And how did you get into working in a law firm doing marketing and digital?
It was very, very much coincidence. So I studied communication. So that was always my passion. And then after uni, I actually set up a little business of my own where I worked with local businesses, working on their logos and brochures. And I even built a few websites for people back then. And then when I stopped uni, I thought, now I want to get some corporate experience, work for a bigger organization rather than just with the car washers and restaurants and that kind of, not that they weren't lovely, they were really lovely, but they just to get like the big company experience. And then I just ended up at my first law firm in Belgium. So I'm Belgian originally, so that was in Brussels. And after a year or so, my then girlfriend, now wife, said she wanted to do an extra degree in London. And so I quit my job and followed her. And then I landed in another law firm. And I specialized in digital communication. So that was in the beginning of when companies started to do social media for the first time. So we were trying to work out what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, what are the policies, kind of how can we make that work? So we did a lot around that then.
And definitely more tricky in a law firm, especially when it was new, I would say, because obviously very risk adverse, wanting to be sure to uphold the brand and to do everything right. That actually would have been quite a tough job, but to begin with, to be part of setting that up, maybe.
It's always a balance between how can we make things as interesting as possible and how is it still correct? Because in legal terms, one small word can make a world of difference in terms of what it means legally. So it's always about co-creating. I always say that we're co-creators with the partners in the law firm, where they basically tell us what the legal reality is and what the correct way of phrasing things is. And we kind of then, again, it comes back to the what and the how. They tell us what to say, and then we'll try to make it as interesting as possible with interesting photos or film or all that kind of stuff.
Love that. Really good. And were you ever interested in the law prior to, or did it literally just happen?
I did at one point when I was a year 12 student, was doubting between going for law or communication in terms of going to university. I especially wanted to be one of those corporate lawyers you see on TV that does like the big deals and so on. But in the end, I got swayed by the creative aspect of going for communication. Actually, I like playing with words. I like playing with visuals, all that kind of stuff. And that is also this thing I still love the most about my job today, is that every day I can actually flex my creative muscle a little bit.
Definitely. And does that resonate with you, obviously thinking of wanting to go into film? There's a real creativity there as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that from a language point of view, especially because you're working in a space where actually every word does matter so much, but then trying to bring the creativity is probably even harder than in other areas, because actually you've got to make sure you're balancing the compliance side of it and making sure the partners are happy, but also trying to differentiate yourself from every other law firm out there to find your audience. That must have been a challenge.
Yeah, definitely. And also the law is a very text-heavy format. If you work on a contract or a legal case, it's all very text-based, and it's very built up in a certain way. You first, in a contract, you set out your definitions. You then set out kind of the actual agreement comes later in the contract. So a lot of lawyers are used to thinking in that way, that everything needs to be very detailed and quite long and quite precise. Well, actually, good content is the opposite. You need to actually say something interesting within the first few seconds. You actually need to make it short and snappy. So actually working with that balance is also quite interesting. But that also means that we can make a bigger difference, because we can be the ones that say, actually, if you look at the data, this is kind of the format that works well. So we work a lot with recipes, where we basically try to figure out what is a very, very good format of doing things. So whether that is, for instance, on LinkedIn, where we do these PDF sliders, and we kind of know what type of image are we going to put on the first slide so that people stop scrolling. What are we going to put in the first 7 to 12 words of that slider so that people not only stop scrolling but then slide onto the next slide, and so on. So we have recipes for what we think works well, and we need to constantly update them because the algorithms keep changing, and people's behavior keeps evolving as well. And we have the same for videos as well, where we know in the first 5 seconds we need to show something like that or something like that. And then it's about proving that to the lawyers. So once you can say, we've done it 10 times, 5 times we've done it like this and it didn't work, 5 times we've done it like this and it did much, much better, then they're always very, very open to trying that new format. And then it's giving them access to the analytics as well, and that they get excited, and then the ball gets rolling that way.
Well, no doubt very logical people, so actually if you can put numbers and data in front of them to prove what's working, then that's easy to buy into, isn't it?
Yes, lawyers are thinkers, which is I think a good thing, because it means they're actually willing to think about a strategy and tactics and all that kind of stuff. I think if you have a good theory and you can back it up with good numbers, then you can do whatever you like, really.
And interesting, so English isn't your first language?
No.
So, and how's that then transitioning, like the degree you did, what language was that in when you were studying?
In Dutch or Dutch. Flemish, which is a form of Dutch.
Yeah. So then when you came to the UK, were you fluent in English at that point already?
Not really. I was kind of fluid-ish. I could speak English all right, but what I had to learn were the cultural nuances, because in Belgium, for instance, it's it's not super common to say please and thank you in every single email, because you kind of assume the people working with you, they're there to do a job as well. So you can just say, can you do this? And then, so after 3 weeks of my first job in London, my boss put me aside and was like, you do have to be a little bit more indirect. You have to say, if you don't mind, please could you do this? And many thanks in advance. And so there were some cultural nuances that I had to learn in the beginning.
Yeah, I can imagine. But also then to help market those firms culturally, to understand the differences there and to be leading with communication being the core part of your role, but in a language that isn't your first language, that just, it blows my mind a little bit, because I do not speak another language. So even when you say your English wasn't great when you first moved here, I bet it was definitely better than most of us could try in a different language.
I think the core principles are the same, and especially when it comes to digital communication, but any type of communication, you have a lot of noise out there that you want to cut through. So the first step is, how can I get noticed? The second step is, how can I get people to care about what you're trying to say? Then how can I make sure that they understand what I'm trying to say as well as possible? How can I then get them to continue on their journey? So every piece of content or communication has to have a purpose and a call to action. So that is read more about this on our website, or get in touch with us, or things like that. And then finally, most communication also needs to be a bit memorable. And those kind of core five things are actually quite culture agnostic. That's the same in Belgium as it is here. Mm. Is it as it is here? Maybe the way you say things or the humor is like a smidgen different. But actually, those core that checklist of what makes good content is the same in most cultures.
Yeah. And does that transcend into video? Because just thinking of you from a film perspective, and I know you said that you're doing more with video at the moment at the firm. So
yeah, definitely. I think the entire world is moving to video, and especially short form video. If you look at all the big platforms, Instagram a number of years ago was only photos. Now, actually, most of the things you see on Instagram are actually videos. You have the stories. You have on LinkedIn, a few years ago, you would get penalized if you would put a video up there instead of like an image or a link. Now, actually, video is the best, the highest performing content. So all of those platforms are actually going quite video heavy, and content is actually increasing. And it's also what people are used to consuming with all these streamers the way you actually the things that you consume in your free time are also very, very video based. And to your question, do the same principles apply? It's 100% the same principles. How do you catch people's attention with that thumbnail that if people scroll through? How do you actually make sure that people care within the first few seconds? Because that's the one thing that people keep asking themselves whenever they look at something is, why should I care about this? Yep. And if they don't get an answer to why should I care about that in the first few seconds, then they'll just scroll on. So it might be that you have a golden nugget somewhere 30 seconds into your video, but if people actually don't continue watching to get to that, there's no point to that. So actually getting to that point of why should I care, and why should I care about that now, is very, very important in terms of all content. And that's also the case with video. So actually your voiceover, or if there's person talking to camera, they should actually, one of the most interesting things that is coming up in the video should come first. And I know there's also some editing tricks. I know a lot of people, you'll see this on Instagram and TikTok as well, they actually put the most interesting bit of a conversation at the beginning of a video and then it gets repeated again somewhere later in the video. That's all to actually play into that same thing.
Hooking them in, definitely. Do you watch a lot of video online?
Yeah.
It's interesting. I was, because YouTube is now actually second to the BBC as a media platform in the UK, which when I saw that, just when I think when YouTube first launched, which I remember, you'll remember, I'm sure. You probably won't remember when it first launched, but it was just cat videos and silly stuff. I mean, I still watch the cat videos for sure. That's what I'm there for. But to think that it's then a platform alongside the BBC, like second to the BBC, and Gen Alpha, that is where they consume, or even on their TV at home, most of their content. But actually, I think these were Ofcom stats, even the over 55s, were watching 50% more YouTube than they were the year before. So all age groups.
I think there's two things that people use YouTube for the most. One of them is entertainment, and that's all the Mr. Beast videos and all the likes. And the second thing is it's actually a very practical platform, and I think the over 50s are probably using it for that quite a lot. How do I clean the filter in my washing machine?
Yeah.
And there's a very high chance that you'll find for that specific washing machine a YouTube video that actually does that. And so I think a lot of people are using it for that. Maybe that will be replaced a little bit with ChatGPT and so on that can but with a lot of these practical things, you want to see a person do it. If I need to replace the filter on my washing machine, then it's much better if I see the video, I see the person trying to open it in a certain way, I know, okay, that's the way to do it. So I think YouTube is also a big one for that. And that means it's also a very important channel for SEO, so search engine optimization. If you want to end up high in Google's results, actually thinking about what people are thinking about and giving them a practical solution via YouTube video is actually a very good strategy as well.
Definitely. And I think it will just continue to grow, won't it? Whether it is that we watch it on YouTube or we're watching it on Instagram or wherever we're seeing it, we like watching video. Interesting as well, the habits of video. Like I often watch video with the sound off, like if I'm sitting in bed watching video. So I want the subtitles there. I'm engaging in it that way rather than annoying my husband because he's probably also watching a video because that's the world we live in now, don't we? We're all sitting scrolling. Probably the TV's also on at the same time. It's a funny old world we live in now, isn't it?
Yeah, we've made it a requirement for all of our videos to have subtitles a few years ago already. And just for that reason, we want people to be able to watch the videos on the train without being, I don't know, the mayor recently launched a new term for it, wasn't it? I can't remember what the term was.
Oh, I can't think either, but I know what you mean.
That up. But there is in terms of you want to be able to watch all of the videos when you're on the go without actually disturbing people around you, right? So that's why subtitles are super important.
Definitely. So you obviously you're quite senior from a marketing perspective now, but I'm sure you didn't start that way. How did you finished uni? You've come over to the UK. Your second job at this point, from a law firm perspective, where do you start? What kind of skills were you using? What did that role look like compared to where you are today?
Yeah, I always think the three most important things to have or to be, and that actually goes for any type of seniority level, but I think especially at the junior level, but I think every level, is first of all, it's trying to be helpful. So when someone asks you to help with a project or asks you a question, it's not saying I don't know or I'm busy at the moment, but it's trying to figure out a way to accommodate that. And when, for instance, my job now, as head of brand, I often have to say no to things that are off brand, but rather than say no, we try to find a solution that does work. So it's sitting down with people and actually trying to work out what is helpful. So I think trying to be helpful at every opportunity, I think, is important. The second thing that is very important is, I think, getting stuff done. I think if you get the opportunity to get involved in a little project or even if it's a small task, actually making sure that it gets done, it gets done well, it gets done in time, all of that kind of stuff is it seems quite basic, but it's very often when you involve people in projects, things don't get done or things get talked about a lot, but actually things don't progress. So actually making sure that things get done, I think. And those two things are not, you don't need a special degree for that.
No.
Anyone can do that. And then the third thing is I think really knowing your stuff. And that is when it comes to your own area that you're responsible for, but also think all the adjoining areas. So one of the things that's been the most helpful to me really is that I've been a bit of a jack of all trades. So I know a little bit of HTML coding. I know a little bit of how to design a logo or how to use Photoshop for an image. I know a little bit of video editing. I know a little bit of, so knowing a lot of little things, I think being a jack of all trades is actually a very good thing in the digital world, means that there's a lot of projects that I could get going on and maybe enhance them a little bit with something else that I would know. And I think that's, if you're in a, for instance, if you're, because you're studying or you want to study film, I think knowing how to Photoshop an image will be useful for that in terms of if you want to put a still in there. I actually think knowing how to write well and knowing is quite a good skill to have then as well, because then you can write a script. So I think knowing a lot of different communication and content creation skills and digital skills at the same time is very, very useful. And I think that goes for any type of digital role. If you want to be a user experience designer, it's also good to know a little bit what makes good copy, because copy is a big part of user experience, or it's good to know maybe how to crop an image so you can make that look good on a page. Yeah. So I would say a lot of these practical skills and having a lot of them in your back pocket is really useful.
Yeah. And I guess it's all very accessible these days, isn't it? We've got tools like Canva where you could just go and start trying to design something. You think back probably when you were first launching into the industry as well, it was Photoshop and you had to have an expensive license, or I think we had a previous guest that said they had a pirate license. How could I get hold of this? Because it's hard to get hold of. Whereas now it's in your hands. You can get a free version of it and you can get trying stuff and doing things.
And there's also tutorials on how to do stuff as well. So it's quite easy.
Yeah. And the amount of stuff you can do with your phone.
Yeah, exactly.
It's when we go into schools and we run, we do something called Beamer Digital Day, and we go in and the students, and they can be anywhere from year eight upwards. So they're what, 12, 13 at that point. And it's like, oh, you've got 2 hours to come up with a concept, and they're straight on their phones to do stuff. And I'm like, wow, we didn't even have that. Like, there was a shared computer probably in the corner of the room that we could take it in turns to have a go at. But they're little digital masters already at that point.
Absolutely. And I think the key there is actually finding little projects that you can practice on, because I think a lot of these challenges or a lot of the skills you acquire by doing things and not working out immediately. For instance, a good example of that recently is we're trying to get into AI videos and trying to use AI videos for videos on LinkedIn and so on. And it's very difficult to use Sora and Gemini and some of those other ones to actually get them to do exactly what you wanted to do. But it's only by actually trying to make a certain video that we have in mind that we actually find workarounds. So for instance, one of them, we had like a rocket ship and that was deflating like a balloon. I won't go into detail why we needed that one, but we needed that particular shot. And actually we couldn't work out how to do it properly. But then eventually we did it by generating a photo of a rocket ship in Sora, and then generating a photo of a deflated rocket ship in Sora again. And then we used Adobe Firefly, which you can now use to put the first shot and the last shot of your video in there. And then you ask Adobe Firefly, can you do the deflating part?
Yeah.
And basically it did that. But it's only because we really needed a video of a deflating rocket ship that we actually got to that. Otherwise we wouldn't have learned that trick. So I think with all of these tricks, it's good for if you're a student, try to find little projects that require that practice that isn't just you playing around. So that could be go to your local baker and ask if you can create a video for them, or if you can set up their website, all that kind of stuff. And that way you're forced into actually getting the little skills that will get you.
Or even like with your part-time job, I know we were chatting, you've got a part-time job, you could just go to them and say, oh, could we create a video to use on your social media or something like that? And it's just trying to find ways to be helpful and to test out your skills and test out doing things.
Yeah, what it also teaches you is to work with other people, because I think one of the biggest skills as a creator or a digital person is actually understanding the brief. What is actually, what is it that your client or colleague or whoever you want to work with, what is it that they're trying to achieve? And then also, it's never going to be perfect from the first go. So it's also working with that feedback and trying to tweak things. And you also learn not to take things personally, but that is just all part of the process, that things change quite significantly. So all of those little soft skills are actually also part of what makes a good digital person, I think.
Just a quick note from me. We'd love you to hit the subscribe button. This helps us more than you might realize when it comes to growing this podcast, ensuring we can bring you the best guests possible. Thank you. Back to the episode.
And actually, you touched on briefing there. Like, the brief is often not the brief, is it? Trying to get to what the real brief is. So whether that is a video that needs to be created, a piece of artwork, a written piece, could be anything. But often the first brief you receive isn't what you then end up creating, is it? And I think that's the skill as well in a role like yours, is unpicking that from the people that have got this dream of this end point, but maybe they haven't described it quite right, or they haven't quite thought of it quite right. And that's kind of your role to help, and your team's role to unpick that and rebuild it in the brand first way.
Yeah, and there's some things. It's trying to figure out what is important to the people that you're working with as well. But, and that will be different from person to person. So for one person, it will be super important that it's in a certain color. And another person won't care about the color, but they really like this certain word to be in there, and they won't budge on that certain word. And it's actually, if you really listen to the people that you're working with and you try to figure out, okay, what is important for them? What is it actually that they won't budge on, and what is it that they actually don't care about that much? Then you can use the elements that they do care about, make sure that they're in there, and then and that people are listened to. And then the things that they don't care about as much, you can be a little bit more creative So I think it's also about listening to those things and listening to what your co-creators or your clients actually care about.
That stakeholder management piece as well, of which again I imagine in a partnership structure of a law firm, there's lots of different stakeholders with lots of different ideas and opinions, and trying to manage that and get what you need to be able to get the job done, because that can sometimes delay getting the job done.
Yeah, and I think what I always think about is that they have the same objective as I do, is to make the firm successful. And if they're successful as partners in our firm, we are successful as a firm. So I always think they never, even if they have completely different ideas from you in terms of how to do things, they actually eventually want the same thing. They want to get more business. They want to look good in front of their clients. It's trying to find that common ground. And even if that's very thin, that common ground, it's first getting to that common ground and then saying, okay, from there, where? And then it's also communicating all of the things it's also communicating kind of what you think is important and why, because there's a certain reason why you're actually introducing a certain concept or want to do things a certain way. It's because you believe it's going to get more views, or you believe that's going to get more clicks, or I think the one thing that I never argue about is, for instance, color use, as long as it's on brand, because I think that's such a, in French they say, des goûts et des couleurs on se discute pas, and that means tastes or flavors and colors you shouldn't discuss. And that's because that's such a personal taste kind of thing, that I think I can't really back that up, saying we should use purple in here rather than green or something, unless there's a good reason for that. So I try to focus on the things that I do think are quite important to get right. So that is, for instance, making sure that it's interesting and gets that hook in and all that kind of stuff. So it's also picking your battles a little bit in terms of the things that are important.
Yeah, no, definitely. I get that. Any questions?
Yeah, so we touched on AI as a whole. And obviously nowadays AI is used quite a lot. How do you use it on a daily basis in your job in communicating?
We use it quite a lot. I'm a big fan of AI. I think there are, especially in the creative sphere, there are some things that I think the big AI companies need to protect, like make sure that people's copyright is protected and so on, and that AI isn't just willy-nilly creating things that are actually part of someone's signature style or stuff like that. So I do think that there should be some guardrails, but with the tools that we have, there's so many amazing things you can do. I always use it as a devil's advocate. So for instance, I write an email and I say, how would this email land with you? play devil's advocate, and then it basically unpicks some of my weakest points in the email, or it tries to figure out where people could have an issue with it, and then you can tweak it. Sometimes I use it for the first draft of an email or something, or an article or something like that. I usually it doesn't, because I'm quite particular about my tone of voice. I usually don't use that, but it kind of helps me with the thinking. So I use it more as an assistant. That's kind of where I play it back and forth. In terms of digital marketing, the video generators are the thing that we are now very much looking into and trying all the different ones. It's very exciting because we've been able to create some really, really fun things that 2 years ago we wouldn't have been able to create. We wouldn't have been able to create the deflating rocket ship 2 years ago. No, no matter how many agencies we would have contracted to do that, yeah, that would have been a stretch. But the at the same time, it still has some limitations in terms of what it can do. So at the moment, we're trying to figure out the best way of actually using it. And that is when you, for instance, we need to think more like film directors. We need to think about not just like, this is what we want the video to do, but these are the five shots we need. Mm. We need the close-up of the rocket ship. We need one from the back of the rocket ship. We need a shot of something exploding. We need a shot of it then being deflated, that kind of stuff. So it actually, I think it allows for a lot of creativity. While some people that are against it say it's the end of creativity, I think it actually opens up a whole new avenue of creativity where you can actually think of and create things that we wouldn't have thought about before. Yeah. We wouldn't even attempted to create before. So I think, yeah, video will be a big one. I think in writing, I think the jury's out there a little bit. I think at the moment it's quite good at kind of improving grammar, for instance. If you've written something and you say, could you go through it, don't tweak it too much, but just improve the grammar and the flow, it's good at that. I find if you just ask it to create something from scratch, it's usually very you can tell it's written by AI, and I think your audience can as well. And when it comes to communication and content and so on, authenticity is so key, because otherwise people really turn off very quickly. So I think it's making sure that authenticity element is, I think, more important than convenience. So it's trying to figure out where can you use it to actually streamline your process as well. It's still being your voice and your perspective, yeah, and your yeah, fingerprint.
Yeah, I've got a version of ChatGPT trained on my tone of voice. So actually, it is better at sounding like me. And if I give a prompt to that versus normal ChatGPT, it's very different. But I use it a lot for brevity. Like, I'll have written something, yeah, and I'm like, this just feels like I could have been a bit punchier. Yeah. And actually, I use that as the prompt a lot. I'm like, can you help me make this punchier? I feel like I've made it overly verbose and it doesn't need all this language in here. And it will come back and I'm like, actually, that's much better. That's much more to the point, but still polite. And we've got our pleases and thank yous in there. But it's brilliant for that, where you don't have the headspace to do it yourself when you've written it.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I agree with that. One of the things that we struggle with in terms of AI a little bit is that hook again, in terms of making sure that it actually has a hook. If you ask a lot of the AI platforms to come up with a hook, it comes up with a bit of a silly thing or a bit too salesy or too that. So I think that will probably improve.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of the things that I think we need marketing people need to keep our eyes on a little bit, that we don't get too complacent and we go and we just use whatever is generated from the start, but that we kind of think, actually, would this be interesting? Would this actually draw my attention in? And because we're humans, we can feel that.
Yeah.
We have that reaction, that gut reaction from the start that says this is interesting or this isn't interesting. And because AI is purely theoretical, it doesn't have feeling, so it doesn't always have that first gut reaction. So I always think that's a good test when you look at AI generated content. Does it still give you that visceral reaction of like, ooh, this is good?
Love that. And if, from a firm perspective, is AI being embraced to be used as, I guess it obviously is in the marketing department, because you're seeing like there's companies that are, no, don't touch it at all. There's companies where go for it, and there's some that are sitting on the fence, like you can use it for this but not for that. And
yeah, I think our brand positioning is being future facing, so it would be odd if we wouldn't be embracing it.
Yeah.
But the but it is within kind of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. So creating some marketing materials is very low risk. It's not, there's not going to be any client data that goes in there, for instance. So when it comes to actually working on client projects, we are a little bit more careful about which systems we use, making sure that it's on premise and all, and that it doesn't go anywhere. Yeah. So we are, while we're definitely one of the firms that likes experimenting with a lot of different tools and like to use it as much as possible, we are also very wary of where it can go wrong.
So
we're definitely, when it comes to client projects, we're super careful with it. But when it comes to marketing projects, the moment we get, we try to get as many tools cleared by our risk team and our information security team as possible, so that we can play around with as many tools as possible and try to figure out ways to make our marketing more creative, more interesting, and more efficient as well, so that we can do more things.
Well, especially because you're working across so many markets, that we've got a few clients that we're helping internationally, and actually the translation side of using AI tools, it's pretty incredible. I was a bit on the fence thinking, I'm not sure this will be able to do it. But actually, we even recently for Aspiration Digital, we're going to Cardiff, and we gave it the subtitles from an English video. I think it was me speaking, and it's translated them into Welsh. And we went to the team in Cardiff and we said, we need you to check this. And they did not have any changes. And I was like, that's incredible. For multi-market marketing, obviously you still have to get that cultural piece right and make sure it's going to be relevant. But if it's translation, it's pretty impressive.
Absolutely, yeah. And on websites, for instance, a lot of translation is like a button here and like a little text there or some help text there. And that can really get quite tedious in terms of if you need a lot of those texts in. So I think that's definitely one of the uses of AI that's super important, and as well as things, because we're talking about digital, things like metadata, which is basically some keywords that you put in the back of a website to make sure that it's easier to get found on Google. Those kind of traditionally, you would have to have someone who looks at the content and then types in those keywords in the back of your content management system. Things where you can now employ AI to actually read an article and put that metadata in there. So there's definitely a lot of those kind of high admin tasks that are quite low risk where AI is brilliant.
Yeah, I love it. It's exciting, isn't it? We were talking about it earlier, that you're starting to use it at school and being encouraged to a point.
More as a tool than something to do it for you. So for instance, homework, you can use it to find, oh, give me some research on this, but don't write the whole question for me.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah, for research, it's also great, these tools. They can do some deep research now that it only takes a few minutes and you get such a nuanced and quite elaborate report on kind of things. It's really, really good. I think there's still a little bit of hallucination in there.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
That's a bit dangerous. We've seen that. We tried last year. We thought I had this idea of using AI to condense some of our articles that our lawyers had written and turn them into LinkedIn posts. Mm-hmm. And the first few that I did, it was like, this is perfect. And then I just went to double check them, and it had just invented a company name in a certain court case, which is, it wouldn't have, because I wasn't familiar with the court case, I wouldn't have picked up on that if I hadn't really thoroughly gone through it. So it can sometimes sneak things in. And the danger there is that it's so good at sneaking it in that you might not notice for a long time.
And it feels quite real. I was doing it, I was writing an article for Search Engine Land, and I'd given it a recent presentation I'd given and one of our recent reports, and said, like, I'd given it its structure, and I said, could you pull out the key points? And then so it did that. And then I was looking at it and I was like, I don't remember this stat. I don't think this is in here. And then I was like, can you tell me which page it's on? Ah, I made that one up. And they're like, it actually just tells you. You're like, can you not make it up? So you do have to ask it to cite where things come from. And then you do have to double, triple check it, because, it's, as you say, it's the fact that it doesn't stand out. It's not like a sore thumb poking out going, I'm wrong here. It feels quite seamless because it's made it up to kind of almost back up the story, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So therefore, you can very easily miss it.
Someone once compared AI to having a really keen but not the cleverest and maybe a little bit of a naive assistant in the team.
Yeah.
So you can give them stuff to do and they'll go and do it, but you need to double check their work.
Yeah.
And that's basically, I think, how to view AI. I think it's a really good, it will make sure that you get things done better and in higher volumes, but you need to, a human eye to double check things.
I feel like it's got its minor imperfections, AI as a whole.
Yes. Definitely. Well, there's real bias built into AI, like especially any of the image platforms. If you're like, oh, could you show me the leader of a company? It will always be a man. It wouldn't show a woman because it's just like, oh, a leader of a company, that must be a man. And there's loads of little bias things like that because it's trained on a lot of data that's out there, which therefore, if there is... like there are more men that are leading companies, for example, it kind of just goes, well, that's the way it is. So therefore we'll put a man there. So yeah, it's, there's lots of imperfections. Humans still have a place for sure.
Yeah. I think a good way of looking at it, I think is, I once saw a documentary about the making of Jurassic Park, the first Jurassic Park film, which is the ones with the dinosaurs. And when Spielberg was looking at that first film, all of special effects were still being made with claymation. So that's they use clay puppets and they move them one frame at a time to actually run, a bit like Wallace and Gromit. And that was how they were actually going to do Jurassic Park. But Steven Spielberg kept saying, oh, it's actually not right. The dinosaurs aren't moving as naturally as we wanted to. And there was one guy on the team that actually was playing around with these computer graphics. This is very early. This is the early 90s. And he was like, I think I can make a dinosaur move on a computer. And everyone's like, I'm sure you can't. And he worked on it in his spare time on this dinosaur. And then he showed Steven Spielberg and he was like, this is the way to go. All of the dinosaurs are in the film are going to be 3D animated. Now, this was a big thing in Hollywood because there were hundreds of people employed doing these claymation things. And they just thought from one day to the next, we're going to lose our jobs to all of those computers. But what happened in reality is that actually the it generated thousands more jobs. Now there's many more people working in special effects in Hollywood than they were in the early 90s. So it's opened up and all of the people or a lot, some of the claymation people decided to stick to claymation and they now do these films like Fantastic Mr. Fox or Wallace and Gromit or that kind of stuff. And some people actually just translated what they could do with clay onto a computer because actually how to create a dinosaur on a computer is exactly the same. You have to make a model. You have to make sure the texture is right and then you animate it and then you it's actually the process is exactly the same. And I think that's exactly where we are with AI now. I think a lot of people are worried it might replace them, but I think it's actually going to open up 10 times as many different new jobs that we wouldn't think existed before. And it allows people to direct films and produce films that you wouldn't be able to do before.
I think it makes space for creativity because you have more headspace. Because I think one of the blockers often, especially in a job where you're busy and you've got this long to-do list as we end up with in marketing roles, all these things that we could be doing and all these ideas, that all the while your head's so busy with this to-do list, when someone then says, oh, I need a creative idea, you're like, I don't have one. I can't think. I've got this list of things. Whereas actually, if we can start siphoning some of that list off to go, AI can help me with that and I can speed that up and I can tick that off quicker, suddenly you've got space to go, oh, I can actually think.
Yeah.
And let the creativity flow in.
Yeah, I think that's and definitely with all the digital tools, and I don't mean AI, that have come in the last 20 years, our lives have only gotten busier and busier and busier because the more efficient we become, it's not that we've had more time, it's just our days have become busier because people expect to be able to do more in a day. So I think what you just said, actually making sure that you plan in that time to think is also super important because that's where your best ideas happen in the shower or when you're having a 10-minute coffee break sitting on a bench rather than trying to work through 10,000 emails. So I think that's definitely important.
Definitely. What's your hack for getting your brain creative? Is it going out for a walk? Is it, where do you get those ideas?
Yeah, I usually when I get stuck, I leave it be for like a day, and I'll just go. I'll go back to it, and because there's the problem is somewhere in the back of my mind. I usually when I walk through the park or something like that, a new idea comes to mind. But I think if you don't leave it being, you get stuck into tunnel vision and you keep trying the same thing and it not working. So it's very often the case of actually ripping up the storyboard and starting from scratch. And it's very hard to do when you're so stuck into it. You need a little bit of that.
Need the space. Distance. Yeah. Yeah. Do you resonate with that? Do you have anything from school where you're like, oh, I just need to walk away sometimes and then come back fresh?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Especially revision for like exams and stuff. It gets quite tedious and you just got to clear your mind and just relax a little bit because it's so... You don't want to overdo it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And your brain is working in the background anyway. It's very hard to shut off a brain. Yeah, exactly. So it's making better connections in the back of your mind. And actually, so I think not getting stressed about it when you don't find a solution immediately for something, that's more important than actually trying to make sure that you find that solution within 10 minutes. A relaxed brain is more creative brain.
Definitely.
Aspiration Digital is the one-day careers conference to help young people get started in the digital industry. We are just planning our next events and we are planning to move around the UK. So this is your opportunity. If you follow the link in the show notes, you can suggest that we come to your local area and get your school listed on the waitlist. Follow the link now and pop your details in. We hope to see you at a future event.
Here's a fun two-parter question, and you can answer it in whichever order you prefer. But what stands out in your brain as your best day at work you've ever had, and why? And what's your worst day at work, and why?
My best days at work are the ones where I'm very creative, so very hands-on creative, really thinking about, okay, how are we going to do that particular project and trying to find ways. And that could be in different ways. You can be creative. It doesn't, when I say being creative, it doesn't always mean creating videos or images or that kind of stuff. Being creative could also be, we have this massive problem. How are we going to fix that? Or we have this process that doesn't work. Can we come up with a new way of doing that particular thing? That's also being creative. And I think then finding kind of compromises with people is always quite fun. I had a really good day last week where basically the stars seemed to align, and I just, every single meeting I had last week, we found like the solution for this thing that we've been trying to figure out for a while. So I think those are the best days. In terms of the worst days, I think the worst days are when I feel a little bit uninspired, or there's a lot of I have a day full of meetings that don't seem to have much point to them or much meaning to them. It's just like you don't see the compass in your day. You don't see what's the point of actually doing it. But actually, if you have if you have some personal objectives and goals, like for instance, at the moment, I'm quite excited about all this AI thing, AI video stuff, and I've made it my personal goal to by early next year to really have mastered this, and really then even on the more boring meeting days, you can kind of dream away a little bit and think about that. So I think making sure that you have a bit of a goal, I think is good. Someone once said, I don't know who, but I thought it was a great quote, is happiness requires three things. It's someone to love, something to do, and something to look forward to. And I think that those are the best days, when you kind of know you have something to do, and that something to do, if that's something creative, I think that's even better.
Yeah.
And then that's something to look forward to, that is that little goal that you're working for. And if you're a student and you're in the middle of exams, then it's maybe thinking about, okay, what is that the career that I want, or what is that first job that I want, or what is the portfolio that I want to create? And that kind of gives you a bit of extra fuel.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, that's one of the main reasons we're doing what we're doing, is to at the moment, I don't think careers within the digital space, marketing, tech, etc., are properly on the map for students of your age. I don't think the current system shows you them. And actually, if you don't know about them, you can't be excited to go, I'm doing all of this because I want to get to there. And actually, you've got still a good choice of options. There's lots of other careers out there, but I'm so passionate about this sector. I'm like, you're missing a huge chunk if you don't know this is available. And if you do, it's exciting.
Absolutely. And the digital sector is such a fun sector to be in because you could still go anywhere. You could change what you want to do constantly, right? You could start off as a developer and actually realize when you were actually creating these apps or websites that you actually like designing the logo more than you do the coding.
Yeah.
And then that's very easy to pivot into. A lot of these digital skills are very transferable. So when I say you need to have something to look forward to or kind of a north star to work towards, I don't think that should be the same throughout your entire career. You can change that quite often, but having something to work towards allows you to actually take action, and then you find actually the things you enjoy more, or you can build up skills. It's inaction that actually leaves you. If you keep thinking, oh, I don't know what I should be doing, and you're not doing anything, it's still better to do something. You don't have to know exactly what you want, but you kind of know, I want to do something in the digital world in general, or something with film, it can be that you don't know exactly what, but at least it gives you a bit of an incentive to do things. And it's in the doing, I think, that you find what you love, what you don't love, what you're actually good at, what you're not good at, all your ikigai, as it's called in Japanese, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's so hard sitting around a classroom table back at school and, what do I want to do? Until you've really done it and got out there and tried it, it's so hard to know that. I think you're so right.
And you don't have to have worked out. I always say you don't need a map, you just need a compass. So that means if you can just think, I want to do something creative, and that's enough. You don't need to know, oh, I actually need to study this, and then my first job needs to be that, and then I when I'm 25, I want to get that, when I'm 30, that. Actually, first of all, that never works out that way. Yep. not a single journey actually happens that way. And secondly, if once you start doing more, you start getting to know yourself more, you develop more, and you change as well. So it's all about just having a bit of a general sense of direction of like, I like things with computers, or I like writing code, or I like, and then I'll do a degree in that, or I'll do some projects in that, and then I'll see where that leads. I think because there's very much an obsession with purpose in the last decade or so in the world of careers, and I think it's great if you found the thing.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people put a lot of pressure on themselves to find that single purpose, and I think a lot of people maybe don't have a single purpose. But you can still have a general direction, right, to move towards.
And I think also you're an interesting example of actually you can take something you're interested in. So you were almost interested to go into the law, but actually you've taken the law with your other passion, communications and the digital sector, and you're bringing the two together. And I think, again, trying to surface that through what we're doing, to not just say you don't have to just go and work for an agency or a software company, or you could love football and you could go and work at a football club and work in their marketing team, or you could work as a law firm. You could want to be a doctor and think, oh, actually I don't know if I want to do that, but actually, oh, I could go and work for the NHS and work in their digital team. Like, there's so much scope, I think, because the sector we're working in runs through everything from a digital perspective.
Yeah.
You could go anywhere with it.
Yeah, and also even within your job, once you've gotten a job, you can often fill that in however you like. There's obviously some certain things you have to do within a job, but you can give that your own kind of flavor. If you're more skilled in a certain thing or more passionate about a certain thing, most managers and most businesses allow you to pursue that a little bit and actually get involved in those projects. So it's also, even if you land in a job that you think this is just my first job, but this is not what I want to do forever, you can still often kind of still make it lean towards what you do like to do, so that helps you build the credibility for actually doing more of that in the future, either within that company or elsewhere.
Yeah, you're so right. Any other questions for us, Ray?
Yeah, you said you were nearly a Star Wars stormtrooper. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so I had a very nearly. The nearly is very important in that story, but is the I have a friend who used to have a flatmate who was the assistant director on the J.J. Abrams Star Wars movies, and she was in charge of the extras, and the stormtroopers are the extras, and they all need to be exactly the same height. They all need to be 5'10", and they all need to have a specific build so that if you have an army of stormtroopers, they don't all look different sizes. And I am nearly 5'10", so I think I was confident enough to put myself down as 5'10". And so me and my friend were actually signed up to do a shoot. We were actually checked in. We actually had our, it was on a Wednesday. I'd taken time off work to go and shoot that certain scene. It was somewhere in London, in a studio in London. And then on the morning, that Wednesday morning, J.J. Abrams changed his mind. And instead of 20 stormtroopers, he only needed 5 or so, and we got cut. So I always say I've been cut from Star Wars. I didn't nearly make it I didn't make it to the set, but I still feel like I'm an honorary stormtrooper somehow.
I think so. What a great story.
Still got the credit.
I love that. Were you a big Star Wars fan as well? Would that have meant a lot?
I'm a big movie fan, okay, so I really like films. So having to be in one of the biggest franchises in movies,
that'd be pretty impressive.
That would be great, yeah.
Favorite film?
Favorite film? I really like the film Big Fish with Ewan McGregor.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I think it's by Tim Burton, but I'm not 100% sure. Yeah. And it's where he kind of, it's a bit absurd, and he's got like all these characters that he finds. Another one I love is Forrest Gump.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I watched that the other day, actually. Oh,
I love feel-good films that you kind of just at the end feel a little bit, like anything's possible.
Yeah. Favorite film, Ray?
Probably The Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, that's a good one as well.
That's a good one, a real classic.
That's a really, really good one. I love The Shawshank Redemption.
Really good. Yeah, films are amazing though, aren't they? You can just disappear into them and just kind of be taken away. Are you, and this is completely, well, it's still on topic of films, but I feel like films have become less a thing because series have become such a popular thing. What's your views on that?
I think it depends on the... I think films are still an activity.
Yeah.
You could still go. If you go to the cinema on a Friday night, most of the cinema, the rooms are quite full. Mm. So I think people still see it as like something to go and do, where you go to a cinema and you enjoy a film from start to end. I also think if you're watching a film at home, it's a different experience from watching a series because you have that start, middle and an end, even like in the film, but also the experience of watching the film is a start, middle and an end. You put on the film and at the end you've got a group. With series, you don't have that, right? It's usually it keeps going and keeps going, which I love series as well. I think that explosion of content that's going on at the moment, I think is a great thing, both for creatives that want to work in that sector as well as people that want to consume it. I think they probably need to figure out some of the commercial models of the streaming a little bit, but I think is a great thing. But I think they each have their place, films and series and so on.
I went to the other day, they did the launch of one of the Diary of a CEO episodes, the one with I've lost his name. Anyway, at the cinema, which was incredible. Like, was sitting watching a podcast in a cinema. Cool. It was quite, and it was an emotive episode. It was the guy from One Direction. I can't think of his name. It was really emotive, like the highs and the lows. But by the end of it, like, you kind of all get up and you're like, I feel like we've been through that together and actually walk out together. So,
it's a communal experience going to the cinema, isn't it? Because you hear the laughs around you or the gasps or the
tear wipes going on. And
I also heard Richard Ayoade say at, I think it was on South by Southwest in London, he was talking about the difference of the different mediums. And for instance, and he talked about every medium having its base unit. And so, for instance, the base unit of a book, I think he said, I might be misquoting him here, is sentences. Mm. So you write a great sentence and that takes you to the next sentence and that takes you to the next sentence. In series, it's all about events. Something happened and then something happens and then something happens. And the difference between a series and a film is that a film, the base unit is a shot. So you get a cinematic shot or you get a close-up of someone. And if you think about it in terms of the base units, you actually look at film and TV shows quite differently, because then films become a little bit more artistic and a little bit more about composition and kind of mood and all that kind of stuff, where a TV show becomes more about like a series of events. I thought that was quite interesting.
Really nice. Yeah, I wanted to see him at South by Southwest and I ended up not getting up in time, into London. But yeah, that looked incredible.
Yeah, he was very good.
Yeah, really, really good. Any other questions, Ray?
I think you've answered everything, to be honest.
Everything.
I've got no questions.
Not well, but I tried.
No, you've done well. And is there anything, Bram, you've not said that you're like, oh, there was this little bit of wisdom I wanted to share?
No, I just think if you if you're interested in a digital career, then talk to the people that you know that work in digital. Most of the people that work in a digital career are quite enthusiastic about it, so they're very happy to help you. And then you can maybe also help people out a little bit in terms of those little projects, whether that is creating a bit of a video for someone or a website or a brochure for something. There's a lot of these small businesses that really really like the help, so it's a great way of kind of building a portfolio to first try out and see whether you like doing it, and secondly you have a bit of something to show for once you start actually looking for work.
Love it.
For sure.
That's been amazing. Thank you both so much. You've been a wonderful guest, a fabulous co-host.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, and we look forward to seeing you on a future episode of Behind the Future.
That concludes another brilliant episode of Behind the Future. Thank you so much for listening. You can listen back to other episodes on YouTube or your podcast platform of choice. Make sure you hit the subscribe button, as that will help us to grow this podcast, ensuring we can get the best guests on here for you to learn from. You can also follow us on socials, linked in the show notes for exclusive content. See you on the next episode.